This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca, iTunes, and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Public health experts now speak of guns in the same way that they speak about viruses, cars, tobacco, and alcohol. After the most recent in a long list of mass shootings in the United States and a recent incident in Toronto, there are calls for a fresh look at gun violence as a social disease necessitating a public health response. The shocking senseless violence of these attacks occurs as violent crime and murder rates have actually been dropping. One doctor involved in treating the victims of the Wisconsin Sikh temple shootings asks, is this the new social norm? We're joined on the phone by Christopher Schneider, an assistant professor of sociology at University of British Columbia. Welcome back to People First Radio, Chris.
Thank you very much for having me back.
Chris, I came across a post at the political blog, which is called Daily Cause, or Daily Cause, on August the 5th, 2012, and you can find it at dailycause.com. It's written by D.B. Cooper, who blogs as Cartoon Peril. Cooper wrote in the aftermath of the Sikh temple shooting in Wisconsin, and I'm quoting, the name of the post was Thoughts and Prayers Aren't Enough Anymore. Here we go again, another mass shooting, this time at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin. Here's what's going to happen. Number one, the police and the emergency respondents will do their absolute best to investigate the crime and assist the wounded. Number two, there will be substantial media attention, the extent of which will depend on the number of people who were shot. If enough people are shot, a special mournful dirge will be written, as it was with the Aurora shootings. In a day or so, number three, various politicians will state that, quote, our hearts and prayers are with the victims and their families, unquote. Four, many people will find themselves without medical insurance to cover their injuries and will have to beg the community to pay for their bills or the medical providers to reduce or waive them. Number five, someone will claim that if he had been there packing heat, he could have shot the perpetrator dead. And there will be some that actually blame the victims for being unarmed. Number six, the gun industry will benefit as sales of whatever weapon was used will go up. The more people who are killed, the better the sales will be. Number seven, people like me who criticize the ready availability of firearms capable of this type of mass killings will be criticized as politicizing the event. Number eight, the whole thing will be forgotten by the general public, but certainly not by the victims, in 2 weeks maximum. And number nine, another massacre will occur, repeat steps 1 through 8. Christopher Schneider, what are your thoughts about that post? The way the media and society, and in this case, I guess, in the United States, responds to mass shootings.
Well, regarding the post, these things, so public shootings, tend to follow a very similar script, as noted in the post. And I think the author of the post gets this bang on, outlining this from what I've seen in media reports. What this does is signify that this process and the subsequent response has become a normalized process of our everyday lives, a routine response to public shootings. I think one thing to really highlight here, and as you note in regard to media and mass shootings, is that media have become a basic way of interpreting social affairs. Many people are not in the public shooting or deal with the public shooting in a very real way, meaning that they're not shot themselves and then they don't really know anybody who's shot. You know, it's a very small amount of people that are immediately affected or impacted by these things. But the way in which people come to understand and interpret these affairs draws through media. Now, one thing we should highlight, of course, is that there are two different sort of camps when we think about mass media in response to these types of events. A lot of people, a lot of claims makers have come out and suggested that movies like Batman, for instance, make people want to go out and shoot people in this Joker-like fashion, as we saw with this individual in Aurora, Colorado. This is widely called the effects-based approach, meaning that the media have a direct effect on our actions, which has been widely dismissed in the academic research literature. Rather, there's what's called the institutional-based effects, or institutional approach, rather, And what this is, the media are a dominant social institution that contribute to the way in which we interpret social affairs. And I think that all of this sort of ties into how people are coming to understand this process, and I think the way this author outlines it in the post is fairly accurate.
If we adjusted that list now for, let's say, the Canadian political and social environments, we might include the phrase, meetings will be held among top politicians about the problem of gun violence. How does the Canadian political and social response differ from that in the United States?
Well, regarding the social response, each respective country, of course, was founded in different ways. You look at the United States, the founding of the U.S. was, on bloodshed, right? There was a revolution and, the right to bear arms, the Second Amendment, to have guns, the First Amendment. These are all codified into, the legal process. In Canada, this country was not founded on bloodshed. Basically it was like, hey, England, do you mind if we do our own thing? And that is why, of course, that the Queen is still technically the head of state in Canada. And we look at the two different countries and the respective, legal process in regard to the social response. In the United States, individuals' rights are protected above all. It's your individual right to have a gun. It's your individual right to say whatever it is you please. In Canada, it's exactly the opposite. The collective rights in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms is given preferential treatment over individual rights, which is why, for instance, things like hate speech are illegal in Canada, but they are perfectly legal and acceptable in the United States. So in part, this would explain some of the social response in that in the United States, it's my right to have a gun. In Canada, it's not your right to have a gun because this could be harmful to the collective. Regarding the political response, I think it's quite similar between the United States and Canada. But one real key difference, I think, to note is that there is very little, if any, political pandering in Canada to any gun lobby groups such as the National Rifle Association or NRA. These groups, the NRA and the United States, have enormous political pull. And politicians do not want to upset the NRA because they want to win an election, for instance. And this being a presidential election year in the United States, we have seen that President Obama and Mitt Romney have not either one of them really addressed head on the issue of gun violence and gun control because they're afraid to make the NRA upset, and their lobbying efforts would then sort of, I think, thwart their re-campaign efforts. And we don't really see that kind of political response in Canada because of, first of all, there's another prevalence of guns in the same way. Also, socially, people don't, have the, quote, right to possess firearms in the same way as the United States. And I think all of this kind of ties into that.
Well, does it make sense then to ever look to politicians for solutions to gun violence? You mentioned the influence of political pandering in the United States and the sense that politics will trump everything else. Tell us more about the notion that we can demand change or even plead for change from our political leaders.
So does it make sense to look to politicians? The answer is yes and no. On the one hand, these are our elected officials, and they must answer to the public. They must be accountable to us. We put them there. So it makes sense in that regard. On the other hand, the rhetoric of politicians, as we've seen, stop the violence, crack down on this, these types of things, the rhetoric does very little to change culture. Importantly, including norms surrounding violence. Violence to resolve conflict is taught and learned at a very early age, and it's part of our socialization process. It's also very gendered. So you think, for instance, little boys are taught to resolve conflict using violence. Fathers might tell their kids, don't let the bully pick on you, go back and punch him in the face. And this is widely condoned and celebrated and in a variety of different ways in society. So for politicians to come out and say, stop it now, don't do this any longer, this does little to change that. At the same time, too, I think what listeners need to really consider is this idea of implementing laws, legal change. These often, that is, passing laws, does less to change things like this than people might believe. I think a real easy or obvious example of that would be the civil rights movement in the United States, which, of course, people always associate with the 1960s, Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. What a lot of people don't know is there was actually a civil rights movement in the United States in the 1870s, nearly 100 years before, where there were laws and amendments passed. And, you know, obviously we saw the rise of the Ku Klux Klan and other groups to sort of thwart these passing of the laws and amendments, and very little was done. Indeed, racism is still alive and well, so one can make the argument that these laws have not stopped completely racism. Have changes been made? Have progress been made? Yes, absolutely. But just passing laws against guns and outlawing or banning guns today forever and stop making them is not necessarily going to change sort of the culture of violence around some of these issues.
People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and the issues related to health and wellness. Coming to you on CHOY 101.7 FM and streaming at CHOY.ca.
I'm speaking with Christopher Schneider, who is an assistant professor of sociology at University of British Columbia, about gun violence. Our discussion comes after a number of shocking mass shootings in both the United States and Canada, and what I, myself, would characterize as a lack of leadership in the political sphere to deal with the problem. Now, Christopher, I'm going to speak now about an article by Marilyn Marchione, or Marchione. She wrote an article for Associated Press earlier this month. It's called, "Is a Gun Like a Virus? After Mass Shootings, Doctors Target Gun Violence as a Social Disease." And Marchione reports that doctors and public health experts want a science-based, pragmatic approach based on the reality that we live in a society saturated with guns and need better ways of preventing harm from them. Now, Chris, what would a public health approach to gun violence look like?
Well, I think first and foremost, it would involve changing the way that we speak or talk about guns and gun violence. Right now, the way we talk about it is framed as a problem, or the problem frame. It's the issue of gun control. There's not enough control. There's too much control. This is the way in which this whole issue has been discussed in direct response to these shootings, or I guess lack thereof, because as I spoke earlier, the presidential candidate and president have been reluctant to come out and speak directly to this issue. But we do see a lot of different claims makers and media pundits discussing this in terms of control in regard to a problem. What this would do is shift the issue of guns to a health frame. And so, you know, we currently have the problem frame. An example of the health frame, for instance, thinking about something else, would be treating illegal drug use as a public health issue rather than as a criminal justice issue. So we're talking about concern for people's well-being. And we've seen actually some of this shift with cigarettes, for instance, going to a public health issue and trying to thwart smoking through various campaigns and so on and so forth. So I think changing the way that we talk about the issue of guns in terms of control to talking about the issue of guns in terms of our health and safety would then move us a step in the right direction.
Now, the Marchione article focuses on a number of areas related specifically to guns and gun violence and gives some examples of what a public health approach might involve. Now, one is the curious rise in gun sales that follow mass shootings. And as I read the article, this could be seen as a disease pattern, observing how a problem spreads. Daniel Webster is a health policy expert and co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research in Baltimore. He's quoted in the article as saying that gun ownership, a precursor to gun violence, can spread much like an infectious disease circulates. He says there's sort of a contagion phenomenon after a shooting where people feel they need to have a gun for protection or retaliation. Now, Chris, tell us more about the applicability of a public health model to the problem, as I'm using the problem frame, the problem of gun violence. What are the strengths and the weaknesses in this approach?
Well, I think one notable strength, presumably, is that this would lead to, this is very important, increased resources to deal with the issue as a health issue more effectively. Of course, we see other types of diseases, endemics, pandemics, HIV, AIDS, you know, the West Nile virus, different flus, and the mass resources that are provided to these sorts of things to stop it through, say, for instance, spreading awareness to the issue, how to protect oneself, all these kind of issues, which we do not do with guns because guns are a problem of control. Guns are not seen as a health issue, health problem. So I think this would open up a lot more resources, and this would help, I think, not only fund this process, but perhaps reducing some of these shootings. Are they ever going to go away? No. This is the same sort of thing with different types of diseases that we've seen. Diseases, you know, the common flu, for instance, we have not yet found a cure to completely eradicate it, but through, say, vaccines, flu shots, other types of things, we have used resources to stop the spread, so to speak, of these diseases, and stopping the spread of gun violence in a similar way through the health frame might be one way of doing that. A weakness of this approach, of course, this would unfortunately not eliminate the issue. That is the issue of guns being widely available. Even if, in fact, guns were, pardon me, banned today, production completely stopped, guns would still exist. There are hundreds of millions of guns in the United States, guns around the world. There are often, you know, contradictory messages as well sent between, you know, using violence to deal with problems in our everyday lives with conflict. So on the one hand, being in the military and having a gun and using this as a weapon, or police officer and using this as a weapon, is entirely condoned. It's often celebrated. On the other hand, using these firearms in different parts of our everyday lives are not. So that's never going to go away either. Guns will always be a part of our everyday lives. We need to accept that. And I think changing this into the health frame and learning to deal with this differently and diverting very important resources from, you know, say that the issue or problem of control to the health issue, again, would be a step in the right direction.
What do we know about the long-term effects of incidents of these of this nature on the communities in which they take place? What have you seen in research? Has research been done into this, and what have we learned over time?
Well, we don't know very much about the long-term effects. As you pointed out, quoting some of the articles that you were reading earlier, the individual points out this eight-step process. I think they note that 2 weeks max that this is focused on, and the media and the public attention and spotlighting of this moves on. So these things have a very kind of short time frame, and there hasn't been a whole lot of empirical research that has addressed the issue of the effects of these sorts of shootings and how we're responding to these shootings. And I think that's something, if we were to divert some sources into understanding this in a health frame, we might have more research to better understand it. A lot of dealing with, I think, guns and public shootings, there's a lot of backlash, a lot of speculation, and it does become often very politicized because, in fact, in the United States, owning a firearm is a very political issue. It's an individual's right, per the Second Amendment, to be able to own and possess a firearm. So in a very real way, people, they feel threatened, you know, when there's the talk about controlling or using more control on firearms, because you, that is the government, is trying to take people's individual rights away. So we have that component coupled with this idea of, you know, fear of somebody attacking you or retaliation. And these two together then, I think, in part also explain the skyrocketing of gun sales after these types of shootings.
What about the secondary effects in the sense that individuals watching the news unfold as it's being reported and then feeling fear about their own safety? Is there research that has been done into this?
Indeed, there has. There has been a handful of books published by David Altaidi. I think the most notable of them is called Creating Fear, published in 2001, I believe. And these books talk about the ways in which primarily politicians use fear as a social control mechanism, that is, getting people to cooperate with government sort of mandates regarding authority, rather than forcing people to cooperate by passing laws and whatnot. They stimulate fear, and when people are afraid, the argument is they voluntarily or willingly give up their civil liberties. However, again, this is a bit more of a problem with guns, because we can't make people afraid of guns without having them buy guns, because that is the only kind of, I think, acceptable or understood response to the gun problem, because it's not a health issue. I think this is something that remains to be seen.
Christopher Schneider, is there anything else you'd like to add to our conversation in the last moment or so here?
No, I think that about covers it. I think it's a very important issue, and it's worthy topic of discussion. I think we should be having more very frank discussions amongst ourselves, with our families and friends, to try to better not only understand the issue, but, you know, maybe in fact start to think about the issue as a public health concern rather than as a problem of control.
Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Christopher Schneider is an assistant professor of sociology with University of British Columbia. His research focuses on culture, deviance, and social control. You can find Christopher Schneider online at chrisschneider.org.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with the Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.